previously on the history of America's 1%.
So, how did Vanderbilt make his initial millions? The preferred methods of the day were extortion and blackmail. Vanderbilt quickly proved himself to be a master of both. Now, one of his first great swindles was through government mail subsidies. You see, back in the day, if you wanted to get mail to the West Coast, you had to go by ship. And of course, the government was there with great bags of money to help cover the costs. So, in the rush to get these subsidies, the steamship companies would corrupt congressmen and postal officials, as was exposed in congressional testimony. And eventually, the subsidies amounted to about $1 million a year in 1847. Alright, now when the annual authorization for the mail subsidies came up in Congress in 1858, some interesting facts came out in the official record. It seemed as though Vanderbilt, despite going to great lengths to appear to do battle with his competitors, was actually taking $56,000 a month of the subsidies to not compete against them. It was charged that this was blackmail money, pure and simple. And then a congressional investigation proved the allegations in 1860. True to form, though, Vanderbilt was never criminally or civilly charged or prosecuted.
What difference at this point does it make?
Good old American traditions. With the onset of the Civil War, however, he retired from the steamship business. And with his looted millions, he set about making plans for even greater swindles on his path to being one of the great railroad magnates.
Get up and howl about America and democracy. There is no America. There is no democracy. There is only IBM and ITT and AT&T and DuPont, Dow, Union Carbide, and Exxon. Those are the nations of the world today. We no longer live in a world of nations and ideologies. The world is a college of corporations, inexorably determined by the immutable bylaws of business. The world is a business.
It has been since man crawled out of the slime.
Hello, everybody. Welcome back once again to another episode of the History of America's 1% podcast, a series where we dive into the long and shadowy history of America's ruling elite through the works of authors who were either silenced, suppressed, or forgotten to discover the origins of the 1% and from where their power and wealth was and still is, keyword is, extracted. And for the last 22 episodes now, we have been reading a absolutely fascinating book which was published around the turn of the 20th century, the early 1900s, 100 years ago, The History of the Great American Fortunes, written and researched by Gustavus Myers, a muckraking journalist, author, and historian, all self-taught, who did the dirty work for about 10 years, and dug through government records and old, dusty library tomes that have long since been forgotten, and he pulled out the real facts on how the great industrialists, the great magnates, the great capitalists, the captains of industry, or as some people call them, the robber barons, really made their money and what they applied that money to. And so far it's been nothing but corrupting Congress, bribes, fraud, and blackmail. Oh, and treason too. Don't forget treason. But anyways, with that said, we're going to be turning now to a continuing exploration of the career of Cornelius, also known as Commodore Vanderbilt, and particularly in this new chapter that we're going to be starting, we will take a look at his foray into what he would eventually be widely known and remembered for, which was his expansive holdings in railroads and general transportation. Now, before we get into the actual book and anything like that, I just want to take a quick moment here and to go back to, I think it was about two episodes ago when we first started in on Vanderbilt. I read a little bit from his biography on history.com, the bastion of knowledge and truth, and we'll take a look at a very, very small section they have on his career in railroads. So, as always, I do this strictly to provide a contrast between the mainline history of these men who formed and had a profound influence on America, and the stuff that, well, in the case of Gustavus Myers, has been totally and absolutely forgotten, ignored, written off, tossed to the dustbin of history, and generally described as a mean-spirited rant from a crazy, deranged socialist, and therefore it should be absolutely ignored. However, in the very same breath that they lash out against him, they always have to footnote that by saying, well, you know, he's kind of mean-spirited, and he's definitely one of them socialists, so you should certainly not listen to anything that he has to say. However, you know, the facts in his book, nobody's really ever been able to dispute them, and of course none of the people who we wrote about who were alive at the time the book was published ever filed any libel suits against him. And, you know, it's some of his contributions to our understanding of American history were pretty great. So, this is garbage. 100% grade A trash, and so it has been for the last 100 years until now. We are digging it up again. So here we go from the biography of Cornelius Vanderbilt on history.com. It says, in the 1860s, Vanderbilt shifted his focus from shipping to the railroad industry, which was entering a period of great expansion. He gained control of a number of railway lines operating between Chicago and New York, and established an interregional railroad system. According to T.J. Stiles, the author of The First Tycoon, The Epic Life of Cornelius Vanderbilt, quote, this was a major transformation of the railroad network, which previously had been fragmented into numerous short railroads, each with its own procedures and timetables and rolling stock. The creation of a coherent system spanning several states lowered costs, increased efficiency, and sped up travel and shipment times. Unquote. Vanderbilt was the driving force behind the construction of Manhattan's Grand Central Depot, which opened in 1871. The station eventually was torn down and replaced by present-day Grand Central Terminal, which opened in 1913. Anyways, there you go. That's the short history. No, it was pretty much one paragraph that on Vanderbilt's railroad interests that, hey, he came in and he revolutionized the absolute major transformation of railroading. So, with that out of the way, let's get into the real work. Before we do, as always, I will be attempting, doing my very best, to keep the presentation down to about 1 hour in length for easy digestion and consumption of the material. Now, it doesn't always work that way, but, you know, I'm doing my best. Also, I will be breaking only from the book to offer insights, interpretation, little things I notice, because, you know, we're not just trying to memorize the book. I like to add a little bit of insight where I find it necessary, because, you know, that helps out. Also, I will only be breaking from the reading to spell any last names because I tend to butcher the pronunciation on those. And also, I find it's easier to search for some of these old historical characters if you know how to spell their names. Also, I will only be stopping to give definitions for any archaic words, you know, stuff that I have to look up, stuff that the dictionary says that very few people are likely to know. I find it helpful for myself. Hopefully you do too. Also, I will be stopping the reading to read footnotes into the book. Now, if they're just citations to some old government record or some congressional testimony, if it's just a citation to that, I'll simply note that, hey, there's a footnote here, and then you can go onto the website, which is hosted currently at fileandclaw322.wordpress.com. Or, as a backup, you can go to my Twitter profile, which is at fileandclaw322, and there will always be a link on the profile there to wherever the website is currently. So you can go on there, and I post all the footnotes with each episode of the podcast. Now, some of the footnotes have been more than just a citation. There's some commentary in there by Myers. He expounds on additional aspects of the text, and some of these have ran from, you know, a half page to a page and a half in real tiny font, and there's been some absolute nuggets of wisdom in there, some stuff that we would have just glossed over if I hadn't been reading those in, and I feel like it contributes, for the most part, to the betterment of the podcast and the book. So anywhere where there's a long footnote, I will be reading it into the podcast and also posting it on the website. Other than that, we're going to keep it short today because this is sort of a long chapter. All right, let's get right back into the book here. We're about 50% of the way through now. This is part 3, chapter 4, The Onrush of the Vanderbilt Fortune. With the outbreak of the Civil War and the scouring of the seas by privateers, American shipowners found themselves with an assortment of superfluous vessels on their hands. Forced to withdraw from marine commerce, they looked about for two openings. One was how to dispose of their vessels, the other the seeking of a new and safe method of making millions. Most of their vessels were of such scandalous construction that foreign capitalists would not buy them at any price. Hastily built in the brief period of 90 days, wholly with a view to immediate profit and with but a perfunctory regard for efficiency, many of these steamers were in a dangerous condition. That they survived voyages was perhaps due more to luck than anything else. Year after year, vessel after vessel similarly built and owned had gone down to the bottom of the ocean. Collins had lost many of his ships. So had other steamship companies. The chronicles of sea travel were a long, gruesome succession of tragedies. Every little while, accounts would come in of ships sunk or mysteriously missing. Thousands of immigrants, inhumanly crowded in the enclosures of the steerage, were swept to death without even a fighting chance for life. Cabin passengers fared better. They were given the opportunity of taking to the lifeboats in cases where there was sufficient warning, time, and room. At best, sea travel is a hazard. The finest of ships are liable to meet with disaster. But over much of this sacrifice of life hung grim, ugly charges of mismanagement and corruption, of insufficient crews and incompetent officers, of defective machinery and rotting timber, of lack of proper inspection and safeguards. The answer found. The steamboat and steamship owners were not long lost in perplexity. Since they could no longer use their ships or make profit on ocean routes, why not palm off the vessels upon the government? A highly favorable time it was. The government, under the imperative necessity of at once raising and transporting a huge army, needed vessels badly. As for the other question, momentarily agitating the capitalists as to what new line of activity they could substitute for their own extinguished business, Vanderbilt soon showed how railroads could be made to yield a far greater fortune than commerce. The Titanic, poor choice of words speaking about ships going to the bottom of the ocean, huh? The Titanic conflict opening between the North and South found the federal government wholly unprepared. True, in granting the mail subsidies which established the ocean steamship companies, and which actually furnished the capital for many of them, Congress had inserted some fine provisions that these subsidized ships should be so built as to be, quote-unquote, war steamers of the first class, available in time of war. But these provisions were mere vapor. Just as the Harris and the Slough lines had obtained annual mail subsidy payments of $900,000 and had caused government officials to accept their inferior vessels, so the Collins line had done the same. The report of a board of naval experts submitted to the Committee of Ways and Means of the House of Representatives had showed that the Collins steamers had not been built according to contract, that they would crumble to pieces under the fire of their own batteries, and that a single hostile gun would blow them to splinters. Yet, they had been accepted by the Navy Department. In times of peace, the commercial interests had practiced the grossest frauds in corruptly imposing upon the government every form of shoddy supplies. These were the same interests so vociferously proclaiming their intense patriotism. The Civil War put their pretensions of patriotism to the test. If ever a war took place in which the government and people had to strain every nerve and resource to carry on a great conflict, it was the Civil War. The result of that war was only to exchange chattel slavery for the more extensive system of economic slavery. Ooh, Gus. But the people of that time did not see this clearly. The northern soldiers thought they were fighting for the noblest of all causes, and the mass of the people behind them were ready to make every sacrifice to win a momentous struggle, the direct issue of which was the overthrow or retention of black slavery. How did the capitalist class act towards the government, or rather, let us say, towards the army and the navy so heroically pouring out their blood in battles and hazarding life in camps, hospitals, stockades, and military prisons? And I hate to cut in on the ending with a question, but I just want to hit on a few things in this little section here. First of all, let's see. Oh yeah, that people were, you know, it's funny to look. We've had some instances of this recently with companies. I think I've mentioned this before, but specifically Halliburton and other companies like that. Contractors who were in Iraq, the Iraq War, the recent one, 2003, I think it was, or five. Who had defrauded the U.S. government and army and on their rebuilding of certain areas of Iraq after we had blown it up. And just like Gus Myers is noting here, that all the way back in the Civil War, folks, Civil War, war was a great time, even when it was between our own people. A great time to defraud the government and make a ton of money. And also, very interesting to note here, Gus mentions that the, in his view, I guess you could say, that the result of the Civil War was only to exchange chattel slavery for the more extensive system of economic slavery. And that might get some people thinking and talking here. But let's continue on with the book here. Gus had just asked the question, you know, how had these people acted towards the government or, you know, the army and the navy who were out there. So, let's try again. But anyways, let's not dwell on that too much. Let's get back to the book. Now, Gus had just asked the question, you know, these big businessmen and capitalists who were defrauding the government and as army and navy contractors, you know, but yet they were all this time exclaiming that they were true patriots. He asked, well, how did they treat the army and the navy and the soldiers, the people who were actually out there giving their blood and life in these battles? How did they treat them? Here's the answer. Indiscriminate plundering during the Civil War. The capitalists abundantly proved their devout patriotism by making tremendous fortunes from the necessities of the Great Crisis. They unloaded upon the government at 10 times the cost of manufacture quantities of munitions of war, munitions so frequently worthless that they often had to be thrown away after their purchase. Footnote number 1. And before I get into this footnote, definitely I would just point you to the very first episode. I did the first part on the Rich Pettigrew's Triumphant Plutocracy book, where he talked about the little army of dollar a day men who were on the, I think it was war planning, or the War Preparedness Planning Committee, prior or after World War I, but before World War II, who were planning so we would not be caught off guard again if another great world war came after the First World War, which of course we know is just another decade or so before that bad boy rolled around. But Rich Pettigrew, in his book, and this was in the introduction to the book, so it's in the first episode. But he noted that, you know, these dollar a year men who so patriotically volunteered on this board were to get America ready to go to war were people who were in the munitions industry and stuff like that. So here we see it all the way back. You know, that was in the 20s. That was World War I. Gus is tracking this way back to the Civil War. But anyways, enough about that. Let's get into this footnote here. And in this footnote, where Gus is going to talk about how the great and patriotic capitalists had unloaded on the government at 10 times the cost to manufacture, of course, munitions for war, and that these were so crappy that they had to be most of the time thrown away, Gus notes that in a speech on February 28th, 1863, on the urgency of establishing additional government armories and foundries, Representative J.W. Wallace, last name W-A-L-L-A-C-E, pointed out in the House of Representatives, quote, "The arms, ordnance, and munitions of war bought by the government from private contractors and foreign armories since the commencement of the rebellion have doubtless cost, over and above the positive expense of their manufacture, 10 times as much as would establish and put into operation the armory and foundries recommended in the resolution of the committee. I understand that the government, from the necessity of procuring a sufficient quantity of arms, has been paying, on the average, about $22 per musket, when they could have been and could be manufactured in our national workshops for one half of that money," unquote. Appendix to the Congressional Globe, this is where he pulled it from, the appendix to the Congressional Globe, 37th Congress, 3rd Session, 1862-63, Part 2, page 136, and he notes that fuller details are given in subsequent chapters. So there you go, right, from the Congressional Record, They were inflating the price to make money, and why not? Never let a serious crisis go to waste, as old Rahm Emanuel said once. Continuing on with the book now. They supply shoddy uniforms and blankets and wretched shoes. Food of so deleterious a quality that it was a fertile cause of epidemics, of fevers, and of numberless deaths. They impressed, by force of corruption, worn-out, disintegrating hulks into service as army and naval transports. Not a single possibility of profit was there in which the most glaring frauds were not committed. By a series of disingenuous methods, the banks plundered the treasury and people, and caused their banknotes to be exempt from taxation. All those good old banks. The merchants defrauded the government out of millions of dollars by bribing custom house officers to connive at undervaluations of imports. Footnote number 2. And just quickly in this footnote, Gus remarks that in his report for 1862, Salmon P. Chase, Secretary of the Treasury, and that gentleman's name, first name Salmon, S-A-L-M-O-N, last name Chase, C-H-A-S-E. So Salmon P. Chase, who was the Secretary of the Treasury, wrote, quote, that invoices representing fraudulent valuation of merchandise are daily presented at the custom houses is well known. Unquote. Continuing on with the book. The custom house frauds were so notorious that, goaded on by public opinion, the House of Representatives was forced to appoint an investigating committee. That's just what we need, an investigating committee. Here comes another one. And, of course, we know that those are simply there to allow a little steam to blow off. The chairman of this committee, Representative C.H. Van Wyck of New York, and his last name, Van Wyck, V-A-N-W-Y-C-K, two words there, Van Wyck. After summarizing the testimony in a speech in the House on November 23, 1863, he passionately exclaimed, quote, the starving and penniless man who steals a loaf of bread to save life you incarcerate in a dungeon. But the army of magnificent highwaymen who steal by tens of thousands from the people go unwhipped of justice and are suffered to enjoy the fruits of their crimes. It has been so with former administrations. Unfortunately, it is so with this. Unquote. Footnote number 3. And isn't that telling? He says, yeah, you know, they never sent the rich people to prison, you know? Never. Whether it was a contractor or a builder or a railroad guy or a banker. Have you ever tried one of the bankers? Oh, remember that quote? Oh, I'm going to have to put that one in here.
That's what everybody does. And so the question I'm really asking is, can you identify when you last took the Wall Street banks to trial?
Yeah, well, okay, you asked that question. Well, here it is, in a speech in 1863. Look at this. That the army of magnificent highwaymen, the robbers, the robber barons, who steal tens of thousands and today millions and billions, I added that in. They always go unwhipped of justice, as in they are never held accountable or held even to the standard of the laws, and that it has been so with former administrations, and it'll be so with this administration, and it'll be so with the next one. And Bush didn't put none of them away, and Obama certainly, he came in right away, and he said, whoop. Hands off, you know, nobody's going to jail for the financial crisis, for the torture scandals, for Abu Ghraib prison, for the foreclosure gate. Nothing. And in a couple more years, when Jeb Bush or Hillary Clinton get elected, You better not. You better not be expecting them to hold anybody accountable for anything. Unless you want to enjoy your medical marijuana, and then your ass is going straight to jail. Or you want to help feed the homeless people, and your ass is going straight to jail again. Or if you want to collect rainwater up in Oregon, then your ass is going right to jail. Or if you... You gotta be crazy to do this. If you want to blow the whistle on some corruption or some malfeasance, you're gonna go to jail. Alright? You're gonna go to jail for a long time. Don't even get me started. Good God. Oh, man. Books get me fired up. Let's go, Gus. Tell it like it is, man. Unbelievable. Continuing on with the book. The federal armies not only had to fight an open foe in a desperately contested war, but they were at the same time the helpless targets for the profit mongers of their own section, who insidiously slew great numbers of them. Not, it is true, out of a deliberate lust for murder, but because the craze for profits crushed every instinct of honor and humanity and rendered them callous to the appalling consequences. The battlefields were not more deadly than the supplies furnished by capitalist contractors. Footnote number 4. These capitalists passed and were hailed as eminent merchants, manufacturers, and bankers. They were mighty in the marts and in politics, and their praise as quote-unquote enterprising and quote-unquote self-made and quote-unquote patriotic men was lavishly diffused. It was the period of periods, when there was a kind of adoration of the capitalists taught in press, college, and pulpit. Nothing is so effective, as was remarked of old, to divert attention from scoundrelism as to make a brilliant show of patriotism. In the very act of looting government and people... Oh, what was that old saying by Mark Twain, that patriotism is the last... vestige of a scoundrel. In the very act of looting government, and people and devastating the army and navy, the capitalists did the most ghastly business under the mask of the purest patriotism. Incredible as it may seem, this pretension was invoked and has been successfully maintained to this very day. You can scarcely pick up a volume on the Civil War or a biography of the statesmen or rich men of the era without waiting in fulsome accounts of the untiring patriotism of the capitalists. God damn it. If that ain't true, if you don't see these knuckleheads sit up there in Congress and talk about the imminent threat to the homeland and how these... we have to go to some crazy-ass foreign country, backwards foreign country, and save them from themselves and teach them democracy because it's some kind of metaphor for upholding liberty and truth and justice, and that if you're the Dixie Chicks and you burn or you disparage George Bush, then you get your CDs friggin' burnt. Because you're not patriotic. Or how if you questioned the John F. Kennedy assassination, you were unpatriotic and without principle and with no scruples. And you wanted to sow deliberate distrust in the nation. Give me a break. Gus, man, you were so right, buddy. You were so right. He says it goes on to this day. Unreal. Get me all upset, man. Okay. All right. Here we go. Let's go back and take a look at footnote number 4 here. It's really long. That's why I wanted to finish that little section. I mean, this is like 2. We're going 2, 3, 1, 2. 2 pages. 2 half pages of a footnote. All right, here we go. Footnote number 4. Gus Myers was talking about that the battlefields were not more deadly than the supplies furnished by capitalist contractors. Now, what he's talking about is that he's going to give you some instances where it wasn't only the war killing the soldiers. All right, it was these so-called patriotic and enterprising and self-made robber barons and their terrible merchandise that was getting soldiers killed. Here we go, footnote number 4. This is one of many examples. Philip S. Justice, J-U-S-T-I-C-E, that's his last name, just how it sounds, a gun manufacturer of Philadelphia, obtained a contract in 1861 to supply 4,000 rifles. He charged $20 a piece. The rifles were found to be so absolutely dangerous to the soldiers using them that the government declined to pay his demand price for a part of them. Justice then brought suit. See Court of Claims Reports, Volume 8, page 37 to 54. In the court records, these statements are included. And now we're going to read from the court record. William H. Harris, 2nd Lieutenant of Ordnance, under orders, visited Camp Hamilton in Virginia and inspected the arms of the 58th Regiment, Pennsylvania Volunteer. William H. Harris, last name H-A-R-R-I-S, 2nd Lieutenant of Ordnance, under orders, visited Camp Hamilton, Virginia, and inspected the arms of the 58th Regiment, Pennsylvania Volunteers, stationed there. He reported, quote, "This regiment is armed with rifle muskets marked on the barrel P.S. Justice, Philadelphia, and varying caliber from .65 to .70. I find many of them unserviceable and irreparable from the fact that the principal parts are defective. Many of them are made up of parts of muskets to which the stamp of condemnation has been affixed by an inspecting officer. None of the stocks have ever been approved by an officer, nor do they bear the initials of any inspector. They are made up of soft, unseasoned wood and are defective in construction. The sights are merely soldered on the barrel and come off with the gentlest handling. Imitative screw heads are cut on the bases. The bayonets are made up of soft iron and, of course, when once bent, remain, quote-unquote, set, unquote, etc., etc., page 43. Colonel, and then later, Thomas D. Doubleday, last name D-O-U-B-L-E-D-A-Y, reported of his inspection, quote, "The arms which were manufactured at Philadelphia, Pennsylvania, are of the most worthless kind, and have every appearance of having been manufactured from old condemned muskets. Many of them burst, hammers break off, sights fall off when discharged, the barrels are very light, not 1/20th of an inch thick, and the stocks are made of green wood which have shrunk so as to leave the bands and trimmings loose. The bayonets are of such frail texture that they bend like lead, and many of them break off when going through the bayonet exercise. You could hardly conceive of such a worthless lot of arms, totally unfit for service and dangerous to those using them," unquote. Page 44. Assistant Inspector General of Ordnance John Buford, last name B-U-F-O-R-D, reported, quote, "Many had burst. Many cones were blown out. Many locks were defective. Many barrels were rough inside from imperfect boring, and many had different diameters of bore in the same barrel. At target practice, so many burst that men became afraid to fire them," unquote. Page 45. The Court of Claims on strict technical grounds decided in favor of justice. But the Supreme Court of the United States reversed that decision and dismissed the case. The Supreme Court found true the government's contention that, quote, the arms were unserviceable and unsafe for troops to handle, unquote. Many other such specific examples will be given in subsequent chapters of this work. There's the end of footnote number 4. I mean, come on, man, it's so blatant. And I just think back to, I read a thing on the Vietnam War and how some of the first guns that they were using there would malfunction all the time. I mean, it's just terrible. It's horrible. And it goes all the way back to the Civil War. God damn. Continuing with the book, patriotism at a safe distance. But while lustily indulging in patriotic palaver, the property classes took excellent care that their own bodies should not be imperiled. Oh, of course. All right, now we're going to get into some chicken hawks here. Here we go. Inspired by enthusiasm or principle, a great array of the working class, including the farming and the professional elements, volunteered for military service. It was not long before they experienced the disappointment and demoralization of camp life. The letters written by many of these soldiers show that they did not falter at active campaigning. The prospect, however, of remaining in camp with insufficient rations and, to use a modern expensive word, graft on every hand, completely disheartened and disgusted many of them. Many, having influence with members of Congress, contrived to get discharges. Others, lacking this influence, deserted. To fill the constantly diminishing ranks caused by deaths, resignations, and desertions, it became necessary to pass a conscription act. With few exceptions, the propertied class of the North loved comfort and power too well to look tranquilly upon any move to force them to enlist. Once more, the government ruled that it was but a register of the interests of the ruling classes. The Draft Act was so amended that it allowed men of property to escape being conscripted into the army by permitting them to buy substitutes. The poor man who could not raise the necessary amount had to submit to the consequences of the draft. With a few of the many dollars wrung, filched, or plundered in some way or another, the capitalist could purchase immunity from military service. Ah, those patriots, those patriots. As one of the foremost capitalists of the time, Cornelius Vanderbilt has been constantly exhibited as a great and shining patriot. Precisely in the same way as Crowfoot makes no mention of Vanderbilt's share in the mail subsidy frauds, but, on the contrary, ascribes to Vanderbilt the most splendid patriotism in his mail-carrying operations, so do Crowfoot and other writers unctuously dilate upon the old magnate's patriotic services during the Civil War. Such is the sort of romancing that has long gone unquestioned, although the genuine facts have been within reach. These facts show that Vanderbilt was continuing during the Civil War the prodigious frauds he had long been carrying on. When Lincoln's administration decided in 1862 to send a large military and naval force to New Orleans under General Banks, last name B-A-N-K-S, one of the first considerations was to get in haste the required number of ships to be used as transports. To whom did the government turn in this exigency? To the very merchant class, which, since the foundation of the United States, had continuously defrauded the public treasury. The owners of the ships had been eagerly awaiting a chance to sell or lease them to the government at exorbitant prices. And to whom was the business of buying, equipping, and supervising them entrusted? To none other than Cornelius Vanderbilt. Every public man had opportunities for knowing that Vanderbilt had pocketed millions of dollars in his fraudulent hold-up arrangement with various mail subsidy lines. He was known to be mercenary and unscrupulous. Yet, he was selected by Secretary of War Stanton, last name Stanton, to act as the agent for the government. At this time, Vanderbilt was posing as a glorious patriot. With much ostentation, he had loaned to the government for naval purposes one of his ships. One of his ships. A ship that he could not put to use himself and which, in fact, had been built with stolen public funds. By this gift, he had cheaply attained the reputation of being a fervent patriot. Subsequently, it may be added, Congress turned a trick on him by assuming that he gave this ship to the government, and, to his great astonishment, they kept the ship and solemnly thanked him for the present. Oh, at least they got a little something out of him, I guess. Yeah, freaking right. A piece of crap that was bought and paid for by them already. They just took it back. Vanderbilt's methods in war. The outfitting of the Banks expedition was of such a rank character that it provoked a grave public scandal. If the matter had been simply one of swindling the United States Treasury out of millions of dollars, it might have been passed over by Congress. On all sides, gigantic frauds were being committed by the capitalists. But in this particular case, the protests of the thousands of soldiers on board the transports were too numerous and effective to be silenced or ignored. These soldiers were not regulars without influence or connections. They were volunteers who everywhere had relatives and friends to demand an inquiry. Their complaints of overcrowding and of insecure, broken-down ships poured in and aroused the whole country. A great stir resulted. Congress appointed an investigating committee. Another one! God damn it! When are we gonna learn? Another investigating committee. Wonderful. I wonder, you know what, the Library of Congress has online a section on their website called Chronicling America, where you can pull up old newspaper articles. I might throw this on my list to look at, but it might be neat to go on there and pull down some of these, see if there's any of these complaints about overcrowding and poor ships, quality of the ships and everything. That might be neat. And I'll add it to my never-ending list of stuff to put on the website, and maybe sometime we'll get it up there. Continuing on now, let's hear about this illustrative investigating committee. The testimony was extremely illuminative. It showed that in buying the vessels, Vanderbilt had employed one T.J. Southard, last name Southard, to act as his handyman. Vanderbilt, it was testified by numerous shipowners, refused to charter any vessels unless the business was transacted through Southard, who demanded a share of the purchase money before he would consent to do business. Any shipowner who wanted to get rid of a superannuated steamer or sailing vessel found no difficulty if he acceded to Southard's terms. Now you gotta remember that Vanderbilt is acting on behalf of the government, right, for procurement of these vessels. So this guy Southard, I mean, he's acting in behalf of the government, and he's running through this guy Southard, who's basically taking a cut off of the whole transaction price, right? Continuing on here. The vessels accepted by Vanderbilt and contracted to be paid for at high prices were in shockingly bad condition. Vanderbilt was one of the few men in the secret of the destination of... Oh, that didn't make any sense. Let me try again. Vanderbilt was one of the few men in the secret of the destination of Banks's expedition. He knew that the ships had to make an ocean trip, yet he bought for $10,000 the Niagara, an old boat that had been built nearly a score of years before for trade on Lake Ontario. In perfectly smooth weather, reported Senator Grimes of Iowa, his last name G-R-I-M-E-S, quote, with the calm sea, the planks were ripped out of her and exhibited to the gaze of the indignant soldiers on board, showing that her timbers were rotten. The committee have in their committee room a large sample of one of the beams of this vessel to show that it has not the slightest capacity to hold a nail. Unquote. Footnote number 5. Senator Grimes then continued, if senators will refer to page 18 of this report, they will see that for the steamer, the Eastern Queen, he, Vanderbilt, paid $900 a day for the first 30 days and $800 for the residue of the days, while she, the Eastern Queen, had been chartered by the government for the Burnside Expedition, last name B-U-R-N-S-I-D-E, at $500 a day, making a difference of $300 or $400 a day. He paid for the Quinebaug, and the name Q-U-I-N-E-B-A-N-G, $250 a day, while she had been chartered to the government at one time for $130 a day. For the Shetucket, he paid $250 a day, while she had formerly been in our employ for $150 a day. He paid for the Charles Osgood $250 a day, while we had chartered her for $150. He paid $250 a day for the James S. Green, while we had once had a charter of her for $200. He paid $450 a day for the Salvor, while she had been chartered to the government for $300. He paid $250 a day for the Albany, while she had been chartered to the government for $150. He paid $250 a day for the Jersey Blue, while she had been chartered to the government for $150. Footnote number 6. I wonder who owned all them boats. Maybe there was payola just in inflating the price, but I think the whole reason it was inflated is, of course, so his man Southard, remember, the agent for him, could take that cut, and then they get paid, pretty much. Let's continue with the book here. These were a few of the many vessels chartered by Vanderbilt through Southard for the government. Four vessels bought outright, extravagant sums were paid. Ambrose Snow, in his name A-M-B-R-O-S-E, that's his first name, last name Snow, S-N-O-W, a well-known shipping merchant, testified that, quote, when we got to Commodore Vanderbilt, we were referred to Mr. Southard. When we went to Mr. Southard, we were told that we should have to pay him a commission of 5%, unquote. Footnote number 7. Other shipping merchants corroborated this testimony. The methods and extent of these great frauds were clear. If the ship owners agreed to pay Southard 5, and very often he exacted 10%, footnote number 8, Vanderbilt would agree to pay them enormous sums. In giving his testimony, Vanderbilt sought to show that he was actuated by the most patriotic motives, but it was obvious that he was in collusion with Southard and received the greater part of the plunder. Of course he did. So that was his scheme. He's agent for the government. Government needs ships. He bought ships, and this was probably his error of chartering boats that they had previously had, the government had previously employed, And so he just had his man, basically a front man, this guy Southard. He'd refer all the merchants who wanted to lease their ships to the government during the war to Southard, and he'd extract 5 or 10% of the purchase price or rental price. And it would get passed under the table to, of course, Vanderbilt. So, there you go. Let's continue on with the book here. Horrors Done for Profit. On some of the vessels chartered by Vanderbilt, vessels that under the Immigration Act would not have been allowed to carry more than 300 passengers, not less than 950 soldiers were packed. Most of the vessels were antiquated and inadequate. Not a few were badly decayed. With a little superficial patching up, they were imposed upon the government. Despite his knowing that only vessels adapted for ocean service were needed, Vanderbilt chartered craft that had hitherto been almost entirely used in navigating inland waters. Not a single precaution was taken by him or his associates to safeguard the lives of the soldiers. It was a rule among commercial men that at least 2 men capable of navigating should be aboard, especially at sea. Yet with the lives of thousands of soldiers at stake, and with old and bad vessels in use at that, Vanderbilt, in more than one instance, as the testimony showed, neglected to hire more than 1 navigator, and failed to provide instruments and charts. In stating these facts, Senator Grimes said, quote, "When the question was asked of Commodore Vanderbilt and of other gentlemen in connection with the expedition, why this was, and why they did not take navigators and instruments and charts on board, the answer was that the insurance companies and owners of the vessels took that risk, as though," unquote, Senator Grimes bitingly continued, quote, "the government had no risk in the lives of its valiant men whom it had enlisted under its banner and set out in an expedition of this kind," unquote. Footnote number 9. If the expedition had encountered a severe storm at Cape Hatteras, for instance, it is probable that most of the vessels would have been wrecked. Luckily, the voyage was fair. God, leaving it to chance. We got 48:50. All right. I'm going to cut it off right here. Unfortunately, I mean, these chapters are just getting long, but you can see the information is getting better and better. And I just want to say, I cannot help but harken back to, I want to say it was episode 16. And just remember that, as that book reviewer said, I covered this, book review of this Gustavus Myers book, The History of Great American Fortunes. The book reviewer said that this part 3 of this book is, of course, the most worthless part of the whole thing, and it should not be taken with any strain of seriousness. So, of course, all these, all this just rampant criminality and absolute disregard for human life that these men, and right now it's Vanderbilt, he's going in hard on Vanderbilt, but this absolute criminality and disregard for human life that Vanderbilt showed during the Civil War, when he was supposed to be, of course, a super patriot. Just remember that he was, I think he had recently passed away. So, yeah, all this information about him, totally worthless and, you know, not worth checking out. So just remember that. But I really hate to stop in the middle of a chapter, but I gotta do it because they're getting long. So we'll pick it up next time. As always, you've been listening to the History of America's 1% podcast, where we've been reading Gustavus Myers' 1909 work, The History of the Great American Fortunes. And as always, this is the information that you're not supposed to know about.
Sitting on a million, sitting on it every day. Can giving your stuff away. Why don't you do right like the millionaires do? Put your stuff on the market and make a million too. Face a betting woman, she bets on every hand. She's a tricking mother for you everywhere she lands. Why don't you do now like the millionaires do? Put your stuff on the market and make a million too. She lives down by the jail on her back, though she got hot stuff for sale. Why don't you do now